Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we will be talking about the life of probably one of the most, perhaps the most, unconventional figures in modern journalism, Hunter Thompson. And our guest for the program is William McCain. He's the author of a recently published biography of Hunter Thompson. The title is Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter Thompson. It's published by W.W. Norton. In this book, he makes this observation. He talks about the fact that even people who had never read Hunter Thompson knew who he was. He was that crazy dude who took all those drugs and was played in the movies by Johnny Depp and Bill Murray, that wild man who showed up on TV now and then mumbling so much you couldn't understand a word. However, McCain goes on to write this in the introduction of the preface to his book. He writes, Thompson was his own worst enemy because he fed that caricature. The fact is, he was a marvelous writer. One of his signature books, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, he writes, is perfect in the same way that The Great Gatsby is perfect. Take a pencil and read those books looking for something that doesn't sound right, something you'd want to change. You'll leave the pages untouched. This morning, we'll be talking about the life of Hunter Thompson with William McCain, who teaches journalism at the University of Florida, Gainesville. He's joining us by telephone. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, listening over the air, or listening on the Internet across the country, either way, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to keep their comments brief so we can get in as many people as possible. Well, Professor McCain, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
The thing about Thompson, and I know that you knew him, is that maybe you have to make some effort to separate the person from the persona, because he did indeed create this character. And for probably most of us, we would know him from the writing or from what we could see. Someone who actually knew the person, was there someone there that the rest of us didn't see because we saw this character that he constructed?
You know, I think at first, because I was probably part of the target audience when he wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and then the Campaign Trail series for Rolling Stone, I was a young reporter, and I mean very young, 18 or so, working on a newspaper in Indiana. And I believed the persona. I thought that the guy that he portrayed himself to be was the real man. And then a few years later, I met him, and I didn't know him really well, but I met him on a few occasions. And this is my second book on him, so we had a working relationship on the first book. But I knew him well enough to know that the real guy was kind of a nice, shy, southern gentleman type who literally, when he walked on stage, would transform himself into that character. And I was a host for one of his notorious college speaking engagements. And you could just see it take over his body and his language. And it was an amplified version of reality, but it was way amplified. And I do think it was a creation of his that was a brilliant literary creation. And then it kind of got out of control and I think took over his life. And before you knew it, he was sort of a prisoner of persona. In fact, he's kind of like his good friend Jimmy Buffett, who's also in some ways a prisoner of persona, except his persona is a little easier to live with, I think.
I attended one of those performances. He came here to the University of Illinois. I hadn't thought about this in a while. It was a long time ago. It was an odd event. He was late, I think, through no fault of his own. It was in a reasonably good-sized auditorium here on the campus, and there was this almost, I don't know what you would call it, festival-like or circus-like atmosphere waiting for him to arrive. So he comes out, and this was there was a big bare stage, and they just put a little table and a chair that he came out and he sat at. And as I recall, I think he was actually wearing dark glasses. He just kind of sat there, and I'm not exactly sure what I expected. He had no prepared remarks. He took questions from the audience. He spent a lot of time talking about how much he'd been paid to be there. Whether that was true or not, I have no idea. But it was sponsored by a student organization. And I think I was actually kind of put off by the whole thing. And I think my feeling was, well, what's the deal with this guy? But there again, you know, maybe what I was seeing was the performance, and in fact, I think he said something like, when he was invited to do things like that, he wasn't really sure who it is they were expecting or who it is they wanted to show up, the real guy or the character.
He even says that at one point, and I quote him in the book, "I don't know who you're talking about. Do you want me or do you want that guy?"
Yeah.
And I think that was really part of the problem, was that he wasn't sure what people wanted, of course, but at college speaking engagements, he would show up, and of course he had no prepared remarks. He was just there for the money, because he never in his lifetime really made very much money off of writing, and the only money he made is when he sold something to the movies or through these speaking engagements, which Tom Wolfe had turned him on to. So this is a very lucrative way to make money. And I know that when I met him, my job was to be the other person on stage and to interview him. So we had kind of a productive session, but most of the time he went out and he said, "I have nothing to say. What do you want to know?" And it was just a scam for him to get money.
He is associated with a movement in journalism called the New Journalism,
mm-hmm.
and there are a number of people who are also associated with that. Tom Wolfe is one, certainly, and maybe also Norman Mailer and Truman Capote and maybe some other things, but other people. But maybe Thompson is more Thompson and Wolfe, I guess, maybe are the two guys that I really think of, and perhaps it, maybe even more Thompson than Wolfe. And they're certainly different men, and they wrote in different ways. Was there some way that you think that Hunter Thompson in his writing was really different or stood apart from some of the other people that we associate with that approach to journalism?
I think Tom Wolfe is a brilliant reporter and writer, and I think what he liked to do was to stand back and write about something as if it was fiction, and to treat his characters as if they were fictional creations and get inside their souls. And he did all of this through his terrific reporting. Hunter Thompson was different. He sort of mined a separate sharecropper's claim within the new journalism field, and it was what he called gonzo journalism. And what it was just him trying to cover a story. He would, you know, the great literary journalists like Capote and Mailer and Wolfe all tried to stay out of the story and let the story tell itself, whereas Hunter was always in the middle of things, and whatever he wrote about, he was always writing about Hunter Thompson trying to write a story. And so it was all about the process. And, it, you know, to his fans, which, of course, there were legions of fans, to his fans it wouldn't have mattered really what he was writing about. It could be about going to Walmart, and that would have been, you know, Fear and Loathing at Walmart. Oh, after a while, he, of course, that's any trip there is sort of like Fear and Loathing.
Yeah.
But after a while, it really didn't matter what he wrote about. His fans would buy it. And I think that was one of his curses. He had this great literary creation, but he knew he was capable of a lot more. But it was so easy to just be that character and see what he could get away with.
Yeah. And it seems that there was still this difference in that when you think about what Tom Wolfe would do, that maybe indeed that part the story was sort of about he made the characters literary characters, and,
mm-hmm.
and you might have seen the writer behind the story. But what Thompson did is not only was the story about Hunter Thompson doing the story, but it was not just Hunter Thompson. It was the character Hunter Thompson. I mean, he made a character out of himself and then
right.
put that character into the story.
Right. He was Raoul Duke. And of course, Gary Trudeau picked up on that and created the character Uncle Duke in Doonesbury. But I think Douglas Brinkley refers to it as the hunter figure. Well, whatever it was this person that was seeing the apocalypse around every corner, and the slightest thing that happened in his life was tremendous trauma, and everything was just amplified and intense, and that was just something that worked really well for him in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and then it became so popular that ended up being the last thing that he ever did a second draft for. After that, you know, he could just send in his notes and people would publish them. And so he never really tried that hard again. His notes were pretty darn entertaining. I mean, he was a great first draft writer. But I do think near the end he began to regret that he hadn't worked harder on his craft.
Yeah. Our guest is William McKean. He's chair of the journalism department at University of Florida, Gainesville, and he's the author of a recently published biography of Hunter Thompson. The title of the book is Outlaw Journalist, and that's something that Thompson said of himself. He called himself an outlaw journalist because he didn't follow the same rules as anybody else, and that is certainly true. The book is out now. It's published by W.W. Norton, if you'd like to read it. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here who wanted to join in the conversation. Let's do that. Someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Your story about his giving lectures and standing up there and just answering questions answered a great mystery for me. When I was a graduate student, I went to the University of Connecticut, and this was back in the early 60s, and we had, Norman Mailer on campus, and they paid him big bucks, and he stood up in front of the crowd and said, "I'll only answer questions." And I'm wondering whether Norman Mailer knew Hunter Thompson and picked that idea up from him, how to behave at these things. But I was totally turned off by it. And I've always wondered where he got that idea of standing up in front of a crowd, getting paid big dollars, and saying, "I'll just answer questions." Did he know Hunter Thompson?
Well, yes, they did know each other, and it's sort of as if Norman Mailer chopped the wood that Hunter and Tom Wolfe then carved. I think he was sort of there first with literary journalism before they started using that form. And they were, I don't think they were close friends, but they knew each other. And I don't know that Hunter got that idea from him. I think Mailer using that approach might have been born of his natural arrogance, and maybe Hunter's was born of his natural laziness.
It was the other way around then.
Yeah, it was just a way to get money.
Okay. Thanks.
I would like to get money that way if you want to bring me to campus sometime.
All right. We can take that up with the folks here at the journalism school.
Okay.
Other questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Hunter Thompson was born in Louisville in Kentucky, and it's interesting, I guess, if I associate him with any part of the country, I suppose I associate him with the West, since he lived in Colorado, and then I think of him as being someone who really has important ties to the counterculture into Southern California. But there, it seems that there are ways in which his personality was shaped by Southernness. In some ways, do you think that that's true, that by his nature he was a Southerner?
Yes, he was. And his mother was sort of, as the kids would say today, old school South, and, you know, raised him to have manners. And she never left the house without gloves, for example. And was a part of the, they weren't a wealthy family, but they aspired to be part of the gentility of the South. Of course, he was raised in Louisville, which is the sort of the vice capital of America when he's growing up, because it was headquarters to tobacco companies and liquor companies. I have some statistic in the book about what percentage of the world's bourbon was manufactured within something like a 20-mile radius of his home. And it was a significant amount. And so I think he started drinking and smoking when he was 11 or 12. And those are habits he never stopped. But I do think of him as a Southerner. And even though Kentucky's just across the river from my beloved Indiana, he had a lot of the characteristics or the charm. So many of the women comment on the charm of the Southern gentleman. But you point out he was in Woody Creek, Colorado for 35 years. He was in San Francisco living in the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood when the counterculture was essentially born. And he was like a little bit like a smart Forrest Gump, and that wherever things were happening, he was there. And he was in South America at a time of political turmoil. He was in Chicago for the Democratic Convention in 68, got beat up. But he was also in the Watergate the night it was broken into. I don't think he did it. But I think the fact that the guy was everywhere is what makes his life story so interesting to me.
His father died when he was a teenager. And then he was raised by his mother. She had some issues. It sounds as if this, particularly this experience of losing his father when he was a teenager was something that was important in terms of forming who he would turn out to be.
Right. He became Louisville's bad boy. He called himself the Billy the Kid of Louisville, in that he had no, when his father died, he had no ties on him. And his mother adored him, but at the same time, she had no discipline over him. So his younger brother sort of became the good boy, and Hunter became the bad boy, and then he began attracting all of his friends, who most of whom were from extremely wealthy families, and he would get them into doing the bad pranks and things and so on. I had a few of them show up at my event in Louisville last week, and after I talked, I asked them to talk a little bit about what it was like to have him as a playmate from grade school on, and they said every bit of trouble they ever got into in their lives was in his company, that they have been exemplary ever since. So,
did he somehow resent the life that they had because of the family they were born into? Would he have aspired to that, or did he somehow enjoy the fact that maybe he was getting them into trouble and that he was a guy from the other side of the tracks?
I think more that he enjoyed getting them into trouble. I don't think that he was jealous of their wealth or their privilege. All of his classmates went off to Ivy League schools, and he went to jail. So, you know, he had a different kind of experience. And but I don't think there was ever any resentment of the wealth. I do think that seeing the class system up close like that, though, did sort of give him a chip on his shoulder. And it comes out in some of his writing years later, like when he wrote about the Roxanne Pulitzer divorce trial in Palm Beach. There's an angry diatribe about how these people were spending whatever it was, $60,000 a year just on cocaine. And he was a significant cocaine user by then, but he just thought, you know, this is an outrage that people have this much money to spend on, you know, pure leisure.
He, you know, of all the places that you would think that Hunter Thompson would not fit or would not be, would be in the military. But in fact, he served in the Air Force, and perhaps that was he was encouraged to go as a way of trying to get him straightened out. How is it that he ended up, after being this bad boy and getting into a lot of trouble, ended up going into the military?
Well, he was sort of encouraged to go by the judge in Louisville and said, you know, if you go into the military, things will be a little easier for you, or we'll have, you know, they'll make a man out of you. And so he went into the Air Force, and initially he got off to a bad start. I think when he got off the bus at basic training, he threw up on the sergeant waiting there because he was drunk. And he went to electronics school in Illinois. But when they assigned him to this gigantic Air Force base in Florida called Eglin, which is, a lot of people think it's the Area 51 for the eastern half of the country, that there are weird things going on there and UFOs and so forth. When he was assigned there, he sort of fell into a job as the sports editor for the base newspaper. And that was the next best thing to being a civilian, because then you set your own hours. You traveled with the base football team, the base basketball team. And the base football team then, by the way, at Eglin included three future members of the Green Bay Packers, including quarterback Bart Starr. So it was a really good team, and he traveled all over the country with them, and that was really his introduction to journalism. Of course, to get that job, he lied and said that he had been a sports writer back home in Louisville and sports editor of his high school paper. None of this is true, but it got him the job, and I think that was really his realization that there was a ticket out.
Well, before that, had he been interested in or shown any inclination to write?
Yes, he had. There was Louisville's a very interesting American city, and there's a whole social structure of clubs and organizations open to kids, young men usually. One was an athletic club called Castlewood, and that was kind of the feeder for a group that had been around at that point already over 100 years, called the Athenaeum Literary Association. And what the members of the Athenaeum would do, they were all high school students, males. They'd get together on Saturday nights and read their latest works of literature and then go get drunk. And so Hunter was kind of the party master, as you might imagine, for the Athenaeum. But he also wrote for them, and his first published works were essays on what he saw as the faults of modern society. And those appeared when he was, I think, about 16, 17 years old in the Athenaeum's yearbook, which was called The Spectator. So when he went off to the Air Force, he called his column The Spectator, sort of a continuation of what he had seen before.
We have a caller here to talk with in the nearby community of Belgium. Let's go there. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes, good morning. I first heard of Hunter when I lived in Colorado in the mid-70s. And a fellow that told me about it said he had met him and all, and said he was, and I always wonder about, said he really liked to shoot guns. And now, is that true or false?
That's true.
Yeah, like he had a a firing range out there that he'd just shoot anything you could imagine.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, he later in his life, he thought he could make money with art, and so he would blow up pictures of J. Edgar Hoover, Jan Wenner, the editor of Rolling Stone, various presidents of the United States, and he'd shoot them and then sell the art. But he also would take propane tanks, such as you and I would use to grill some weenies on a Saturday afternoon, and he would take those and he would shoot them and blow them up. So he was very into shooting. He had a gun, like all kids in Louisville. He had some sort of rifle when he was young, but he really became interested in hunting in the early 60s when he lived in Big Sur, California, another adventurous part of his life where his neighbors were Henry Miller and Joan Baez. And he would hunt in the woods around there, and that was just a habit he carried with him the rest of his life. But he obviously was proficient with guns, and when he took himself out, he knew that the gun he was using would not leave a horrible scene.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. He apparently was honorably discharged from the military, although I still can't quite picture, if what I know, but I can't quite picture this as being a guy that's going to salute crisply and follow orders and march in formation. How did he manage to get through and at least be honorably discharged?
It was a negotiated honorable discharge. It was, if we give you this, will you go away? but his commanding officer in the communications division at the Air Force Base would come into his office in the morning and find Hunter passed out drunk on his couch in the inner office. So he was insubordinate to the extreme, but he got the job done, and so they liked the fact that he was putting out a sports section that people liked to read. But, after a year of that, they'd had enough. I think he actually ended up serving something like only 16 months of his 2 years.
Hmm. He, after that, went in and he had a number of different jobs. He worked for some newspapers. He worked for a short period of time for Time magazine. And it seemed that it was sort of the same issue over and over again, that this was someone who would not be disciplined and who would not go with the program and was always someone who had his own ideas about what he was going to do. And it sounds like none of his employers really had much tolerance for that.
Right. He was arrogant at that point without portfolio. He hadn't done anything to earn the arrogance, but he knew he would. And so he always looked down on the people that he was working for. And he held grudges, 4 or 5 years later, long after he left Time magazine. He was so angry at a certain editor there that he still would collect flies on fly paper and pack it up and send it to that editor just so he'd open the envelope and find all these dead flies. I mean, that's a grudge. And but he spent his time at Time magazine doing something that I thought was really unusual, and it showed his discipline in that he didn't have the benefits of formal schooling, didn't go off to the Ivy League university, so he thought the way to teach himself to write was to retype books by people he admired. And so he was basically a copy boy at Time, and there would be long down periods. And he had a little cubbyhole there at the magazine, and he would prop open The Sun Also Rises, let's say, and just retype it. And he always resisted the urge to make any changes or to rewrite it or anything. He would just retype the book as is. And he said he wanted to feel what it felt like to have those words pass through his body, through his mind, and out through his fingers. And so that's when he said he learned about the value of rhythm in writing. He said, I see writing in a musical sense. I like gibberish if it sings.
Hmm. And do you think that, as a writer, journalist, do you think that something like that could actually work? That you could, by doing what he did, you actually could get something of a feel for what was going through that person's head when Ernest Hemingway, for example, wrote that the first time through?
You know, I don't know. I haven't tried it, but I think it's an interesting concept. I do think I don't know if that was the reason that he developed this distinctive and intoxicating style, but as a teacher of writing for 30 years, he's been a great friend in a way, because so many of my students are so enamored of him that they really want to write like him, and I say, well, go ahead. And so they do it, and they look like utter fools, and I say, well, see, the reason is there's only one guy that could write like Hunter Thompson, and he's dead now, but there's only one person that can write like you. And so I think it was a great way for him to explore writing and find the mysteries of their style, and I think that's always the step toward finding your own style.
He did, maybe in terms of his newspaper gigs, the one that lasted the longest was at the National Observer.
Mm-hmm.
What did they see in him enough so that at least they kept him on the payroll for a while?
Well, the National Observer, give a brief history, was seen as the Sunday edition of the Wall Street Journal. And they really didn't have any reporters at the start. What they were going to do is to rewrite the news and kind of give it a seamless by one person, for one person voice. And they didn't have very many reporters. And so when Hunter was in South America and he sent his first article in and said, I understand you're starting this newspaper. What do you think of this? They signed him on because he gave the newspaper its roving reporter in South America. And they liked him. They appreciated the weird take he had on everything. They also gave him the license to write a great deal in the first person. And his stories from South America are really good, strong, traditional journalism, but they're also a step into gonzo, because you do sense that voice. They had to bleep him out or use asterisks or whatever to eliminate some of his swear words now and then in the good old National Observer, but it was a really good relationship as long as he was, you know, a few thousand miles away. When he returned to the States and they offered him a cubicle job, he didn't take it, but he did stay as a correspondent. And it seems like the closer he was to the editors, the worse they got along until finally they parted ways.
Mm. So based on some of his experiences in South America at this time, he wrote a novel, which was actually not published until later. He tried to get it published, and he was turned down. And it was published later once he was established. This is The Rum Diary. What kind of a book is that?
You know, it's funny you bring that up, because I'd heard about this for years. I asked him about it when I interviewed him for the first book back in 1990, and he was always a little bit evasive about it. It's about his time in Puerto Rico. It's very closely based on his experience when he was there working for a sports magazine, and a good friend of his from Louisville had come down to stay with him, and also the woman who became his wife. So it's a little bit of an amped up version of that reality. They turned it into a little bit more of a love triangle than it was. But, you know, I'd heard about it for years, and long after Hunter was famous, and it wasn't coming out, and then finally it was coming out, I guess, about 1998. And I thought, well, there's got to be a good reason why a novel by a best-selling author with this great track record has not been published, and it must be because it stinks. And then I read it, and I thought it was really good. And it's become an extremely popular book with my students. They really, really like it, and it does make you wish that he had pursued writing fiction, as you know, as much as this is fiction. He did write another complete novel that hasn't been published, and maybe now that he's dead. But the Rum Diary it was surprisingly good.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, William McKean. He teaches journalism at the University of Florida, Gainesville, and is the author of a newly published biography of Hunter Thompson. The title of the book is Outlaw Journalist. It's published by W.W. Norton, out now in the bookstore if you want to look at it. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Probably the thing that that really got him established and kind of put him on the map, so to speak, was the article and then later the book that he wrote about the Hells Angels. How did he get involved with Hells Angels?
You know, that was an idea. He was a fount of ideas for his friends, and I kind of tick off in the book what books he sort of conceived, and one was The Boys in the Bus for Timothy Krause. He had the idea for what became The Selling of the President for Joe McGinnis. He was kind of on the trail of what became The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test for Tom Wolfe, but Hell's Angels, his first published book, was actually a suggestion from the editor of The Nation magazine, Kerry McWilliams, who wrote to him and said, your work is interesting. I'd like you to look into these motorcycle gangs that are in the press all the time. And so he went out and initially wrote, I think he was getting $100 for the article, but he spent a phenomenal amount of time hanging out with the Angels in order to write the story. And when the story appeared about a week later, his mailbox was stuffed with offers from book publishers to ask him to do a whole book on the Hells Angels. And they would have called, except his phone had been disconnected for non-payment. And so he took the one that offered real money without having to do any more work, no prospectus, no sample chapter or anything, and that was with a paperback division of Random House. But once he started sending in the manuscript pages, you know, 30, 40 pages at a time, they realized it was so good that they moved it up to a hardcover publication. And that was really the thing that did make him famous once again as a character, as the crazy dude that ran around with those outlaws.
Well, is the thing that again maybe separates him and his work from what other reporters might have done is the extent to which he immersed himself in the world and the lives of the people he was writing about?
Well, you know, he immersed himself to a certain extent, but he never rode with them on a motorcycle. First of all, he didn't want a Harley Davidson. He got a, you know, I can't remember what it was without checking the book, but he got a motorcycle of which the Angels did not approve. So he followed them in his Rambler. He didn't pretend to be an angel, but he went everywhere that they went. And for the first part of it, sort of methodically playing the Dow Jones reporter, he just, you can read the first part of the book, and it's well-spaced, it's well-researched. In fact, it's almost, to use that kiss of death word, scholarly. And then halfway through the book, he realized that his deadline was a week away, and that, maybe I'll have to give back the money if I don't make the deadline. So he kissed his wife and child goodbye and checked into a motel with, you know, a couple cases of beer and some amphetamines, and he wrote the last half of the book in 6 days. And you can really tell in the book there's almost a seam where he goes from being the traditional reporter standing back and watching to being much more frenetic and involved.
For the record, it was a BSA motorcycle.
That's right.
not muscular enough for the Angels.
That would not have been the thing.
We have a caller here to talk with here in Champaign-Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Can you say more about finances in general? Like, did all this pay well, or did he basically have some money to allow his travels? And by the way, a bookstore recently put out all his books, and next to them, the cartoon character that's his extension that lives on it with an action figure. That's the Duke guy. Can you say something about that?
I happen to have one of those action figures. Seems like Hunter touched everyone's life, and not long after it was announced I was doing this book, one of the custodians at my university came in and said, "Hey, you're doing that book on Hunter Thompson." I knew him when I was a hippie at the end of the 60s. My wife and I kind of got stranded there in Aspen, and he let us pitch a tent on his property, and we stayed there for 6 months. And it was just amazing that wherever I go, I seem to run into somebody with a story. But that guy gave me a copy of the book you're referring to, which I think is called Action Figure, and it's a Gary Trudeau Doonesbury anthology, and it came with an action figure of Uncle Duke with a cigarette in his holder. So, but as far as making money, I think the revelation to me came when he published his second book of letters in the year 2000, and that was the book called Fear and Loathing in America. The first volume, The Proud Highway, is about his apprenticeship as a writer right up until the time he did Hell's Angels. Well, the second book is about the years in which he was writing Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, and was probably the most famous journalist in America after Walter Cronkite. And the amazing thing about that book of letters is that almost all of them are all about begging for money, about they're going to cut off the power if I do not get this check, please pay me. Or I can't even repeat what he would say. He's after somebody to pay his expenses for a story that they did. And he was constantly in a battle with Jan Wenner of Rolling Stone over expenses because Hunter wanted to, in order to immerse himself in the story, I think he felt he needed to have cocaine sometimes or some other substance. and he would put that on his expense report. And Winter would pay sometimes, and other times he would not. But it until the speaking engagements began to kick in the late 70s, and that's also when he sold one of his articles to be made into a film, the film Where the Buffalo Roam. Until then, he was always living a hand-to-mouth existence. He was never a wealthy man. And in fact, his ownership of Owl Farm is sort of in dispute. It's maybe he was renting or leasing all these years. He didn't really own it, but he treated it as his own. So he was, sad to say, not as wealthy as his celebrity would indicate.
What did he think about Uncle Duke?
He claimed to hate it, and I think he really did, in that it to turn his life into a cartoon character. It wasn't as if he didn't have that problem without Gary Trudeau, but I think Trudeau amplified it. And he really resented the fact that there was discussion of his marriage, his first wife Sandy, in the cartoon strip. But after several years, one of his friends told me that, you know, if Uncle Duke hadn't appeared in the Doonesbury strip for a couple of weeks, that he would begin to get nervous. And he said, well, maybe I need to do something so that he'll do another Uncle Duke. So I think he had a love-hate relationship with it. I'd say it's more on the hate side of the ledger.
You know, we talked a little bit earlier about the writers that one would consider to be his peers, people like Tom Wolfe and Capote and maybe also Mailer, although he was a little bit older. If you think about writers that would have been spiritual fathers in a sense, the guys that I think of are people like Jack Kerouac or William Burroughs, the beat writers. And I wondered if he knew their work and would have said that he found anything there that was inspirational.
I think he liked them to a certain extent. I think he sort of felt like after a couple of books of Kerouac's, he was done. I think the writer that is sort of an unsung great American writer that was influential on Hunter was Terry Southern. And Terry Southern, of course, is now more well-known for having written the screenplays for Dr. Strangelove and Easy Rider and Barbarella, but when he used to do stories for Esquire, including one about a baton-twirling competition among high school girls at the campus of Ole Miss. And if I were to give that to you and wipe off the byline, you would swear that it was Hunter Thompson. But it was done in 1962 when Hunter was an unknown journalist in South America. So I'm not saying that Hunter necessarily borrowed that style from him, but I think it was... I think Southern was some sort of influence on him.
What did he think? What did Hunter Thompson think about most of the people who, younger than him, who really embraced the counterculture, particularly people who went looking for that life and looking for it and ended up in Haight-Ashbury?
Well, you know, there was a wonderful letter that he wrote to a kid that's reprinted in the Proud Highway. And the kid wrote in after reading Hell's Angels about how cool the angels were and how he wanted to be an angel and could Hunter hook him up. And Hunter wrote back what I consider his fatherly advice is, son, do you really want to do that? Do you really want to tie yourself in with this band of losers? You know, there's so much more to your life than that. And I think that throughout his career he was sort of besieged by fans who I don't think really got it. I think they were all for dissent, as he was, but he was for intelligent dissent. And I think that they saw the drunken, drug-addled buffoon, and that's the part that they emulated, and, you know, the caricature, rather than the intelligent man who was, you know, sort of picking apart our society, the politics, the class structure, and so on and so forth. So I think he was... as I say in the book, he's the favorite writer for a lot of people who don't read, and that he was that famous, that people knew who he was without having read a word. And I think that kind of bothered him, in that I don't think he ever really wanted the fame. And I think the fame was a great curse to him. But he did want people to read his work, and he took the work, I think, very seriously for a long time. And even when he wasn't rewriting, I think he was still serious about what he said.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just want to again introduce our guest, William McKean. He teaches journalism at the University of Florida, Gainesville, and is the author of a newly published biography of Hunter Thompson. The title of his book is Outlaw Journalist. It is published by W.W. Norton. 333-9455, the number here in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to call in, join the conversation, toll-free 800-222-9455. Probably his signature work may be the thing that he might be better known for than anything else is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, something that really also established his style, his technique, and perhaps also this thing that we were talking about earlier, this character that perhaps was a facet of him, was not completely him, but people came to know as Hunter Thompson. Tell us about that book.
Well, it was actually kind of the end result of a long struggle he'd had. After publishing Hell's Angels, he signed on with Random House to write a book called The Death of the American Dream, which sounds awfully ponderous. And he worked on this book for 2 or 3 years, and he couldn't deal with it. He didn't know what to write. He was upset, I guess that's putting it mildly, over the assassinations of the 1968 Democratic Convention, the whole political miasma of Vietnam, etc. And he wanted to wrap all those feelings up in this ponderous book on the death of the American dream. And he failed. He was just unable to do the book. But a couple years later, he took these two magazine assignments, and they were also failures. But the two assignments sort of gave him the narrative meat of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, in which he kind of subtly dealt with the death of the American dream. It was a lot of it was between the lines, and in fact, he said that when he was writing it, he didn't know or didn't realize, I guess, the larger themes he was dealing with. And so I think he took something, the idea of that would have made for a really horribly boring book, and turned it into a kind of a masterwork. And the two magazine assignments were these. He was sent to Las Vegas by Sports Illustrated to write basically a 250-word copy block that was going to go with a photo story about a motorcycle race. And he ended up turning in 20,000 words or something. And then was sent back about a month later to Las Vegas by Rolling Stone to cover the District Attorney's Conference on Drug Abuse, which was kind of funny because, of course, he and his partner, the attorney Oscar Acosta, were there abusing as many drugs as they could, but kind of hiding in plain sight from all these police officers and DAs who were there to try to understand the drug menace. And so that formed the narrative arc of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, those two stories.
Mm-hmm. We have somebody calling in here, someone on a cell phone. We'll get them on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I was just wondering if you could comment at all on the piece that Dr. Thompson wrote on the day after 9/11 on 9/12 for Sports Illustrated.
Okay. You know, a lot of people, including Jan Winter of Rolling Stone, seem to think that when he left Rolling Stone, he lost it. And I don't think so. I think some of the pieces that he wrote in his later years, including those for ESPN and the San Francisco Examiner, were excellent. And a lot of people say, well, they're so short, you know, they're only 750 words. And as a journalist, my response is, your point is, as if there's something wrong with brevity. I think that showed that he was in control. And I do think that the piece he wrote after the terrorist attacks of 9/11 is one of the strongest things he wrote in his whole career. And he makes a lot of predictions that have, sad to say, come true. And he was, I think, underrated as not as a Nostradamus or anything, but as sort of a political thinker. I think he had surrounded himself his whole adult career with very smart political organizers and politicians and so forth. And I think he had a pretty good grasp of things, and he knew what would happen.
How would you characterize his politics?
Well, it was whatever was anti-establishment. I don't think he ever wanted to be, until the very end at least, I don't think he ever wanted to be in a position where he was seen as necessarily endorsing someone. Like, obviously, in the 72 campaign, He loved George McGovern and admitted he would vote for him, but I don't think he wanted to cross that line into mere advocacy. He always wanted to, in some ways, stay on the outside. And he was furious when he wrote a very kind article about Jimmy Carter in 1976 that really brought Carter front and center. But when it was run in Rolling Stone, Jan Wenner put it on the cover as the cover story with the cover line, an endorsement with Fear and Loathing. And he said, you know, journalists do not endorse candidates. We do not do that. But I think he was so upset with the post 9/11 world that he did sort of cross the line a little bit in endorsing John Kerry, and in fact made campaign appearances on his behalf. And Kerry at one point said he planned to make Hunter vice president of the United States. So that cheered him up. But I think after that election was lost in 2004, that's when Hunter began to shut down and prepare to kill himself.
Why did he commit suicide?
Well, in addition to the general political malaise, his body was going. I mean, he had ingested all these drugs and alcohol all of his life with no visible effect. I call him the genetic miracle in the book. But it wasn't that I think was bringing him down. But near the end, he had a knee replacement. He had spinal surgery. He broke his leg and was in a wheelchair. And when I was working on the book, I had an accident and ended up in a wheelchair and couldn't even move it myself because my arms were also affected. And I understood helplessness, and I knew I would walk again and that, you know, I would recover. But he was 67, and I think he knew that this was the life, that he was going to be dependent on someone else to even go to the bathroom. And I think, having been through that myself, I think I understand the humiliation of being so dependent on someone else. Mm-hmm. And I think that was probably the reason.
And we were talking in the beginning about the fact that even people who really didn't know much about him or perhaps had not read his work had the sense of who he was, and that one of the things that was famous about him is that he was a famous substance abuser in copious amounts, and the kind of guy who could drink or do drugs and do anybody else under the table. It seemed like he was always going to be the last man standing.
Right.
What was that about? I mean, you have to wonder, well, is this some exercise in lifelong self-medication, or does something like that become a habit? Literally a habit after a while. Why do you think that was?
I think it's a habit, and one of his friends told me that you know, he would drink 24/7, but he was never drunk. It was just part of who he was, and there were other people that could outdo him, because when I was out in Aspen, I was staying at home of one of Hunter's friends. He had a picture of himself hanging on the wall standing next to Hunter, and they're both holding up these numbers, and I said, what's the story behind that? And he says, those are our blood alcohol scores, and his was higher than Hunter's. So I think he kind of kept all the fires idling, but I don't think if he ever did cross the line, and occasionally he did get drunk, he was ashamed of himself. But if you or I were to go over to his house and, you know, have a few too many, he'd say, drive them home. I don't want them here. He did not suffer drunks at all.
Mm. He had a long-running relationship and perhaps troubled relationship with Rolling Stone, and maybe of any publication, that's the thing that he's identified with, and had this troubled sort of relationship with Jan Wenner, the guy who was the publisher. Did you talk with him and talk with him about, with Wenner, about what he thought of Thompson?
Yes, he thinks, he wishes that Hunter had never snorted cocaine. He thinks that was the beginning of his end. I think that began in the mid 70s. His first wife said the same thing. I think Wenner thought he became more of a victim of his bad habits as the time went on. They did have a very troubled relationship, and yet they did a lot of great work together. And Wenner deeply loves Hunter, and I think it's only natural that he would say, you know, after he left me, he was no good, which is what he said in his book, Gonzo, and that deeply offended Hunter's widow, Anita. I do believe Hunter did write a lot of good stuff the last 30-so years of his life that did not appear in Rolling Stone. He also protected Wenner in that second book of letters. There were a lot of letters in there that were really vicious attacks on Wenner for things he did for his penny pinching, for firing Hunter when he was on his way to a war zone, leaving him without health insurance. And yet Hunter, out of loyalty to Winter and against the advice of his editor, took those letters out because he didn't want to hurt him.
The man and the work certainly are a product of their time, and you can read it that way. Is there, though, you think something here that transcends the time?
I think it will endure. I think it will be sort of a great personal. His work will be a great personal history of at least half of the 20th century because he wrote and published for 50 years. I think that's a great record. I do think the comparison with Mark Twain that I made first in 1991, but then when Tom Wolfe made that comparison after Hunter's death, everyone talked about what a genius he was. I was there first, but I do think he had that. He has that sort of epic look at life, everything being, apocalyptic, everything being a journey. I think that that his work will last. And I was writing this knowing that there was a built-in audience, the Hunter Thompson fans, who are interested in the man. But I was kind of writing this for all those people who always wondered what the deal was with that guy. You know, why should I care about him? Mm. And so I sort of hope that when you reach the end of the book, you've gone through two or three hankies in the last chapter, and now you understand what the fuss was about, and now you'll go read Hunter Thompson.
I suppose that for some people he would be something of a hero, and I guess that other people might be more inclined to look at him as a tragic figure. Yeah.
Well, he might be a little bit of both in that I do think that as I have a different conception of heroics, but I do admire him for his fierce devotion to honesty, no matter how ugly it might be, and even if it was, ugliness from himself. But I do think that he was a man who had so much talent that he could succeed. He could be a great writer by not using very much of it. And that I think he came to realize near the end that there was so much more there that he could have done, but he didn't. And I don't know why. I don't blame it on the substance abuse. Mm. I blame it on just seeing the sort of organizing principle of his life being what he could get away with.
The book is Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter Thompson, published by W.W. Norton, by our guest William McKean. He's teaches journalism at University of Florida in Gainesville. Mr. McKean, thanks very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.